Hello and welcome to the podcast of MoralApologetics.com. We're glad you're here. I'm your host, Jonathan Pruitt. And as always at MoralApologetics.com, our aim is to get you thinking about the moral argument because it has the ability to both illuminate the mind and stir the heart. On this week's episode, we're going to be continuing a discussion that we had started a couple weeks ago, actually. We took off Easter, and I hope you enjoyed all the poetry by Professor Elton Higgs and the Yes, I by Dr. Baggett that we had up. But if you haven't listened to that episode, I encourage you to go back and check it out because it's going to be important for setting up the context of today's. We're going to be talking again about moral epistemology, and that is, how do we know moral truths? And as a reminder, Dr. Baggett gave us this example of the time when he came to know moral truth when he was very young. He talks about seeing on television a commercial where a person was giving food to a starving child and recognizing immediately that that was a good and right thing for that man to do. That's important because we're going to be referring to that example quite a bit today. But, you know, just keep in mind that when he came to believe that that was good and right, he didn't, you know, have some sort of philosophical argument or infer his way to that truth. Rather, it was just an immediately recognized thing that he saw this scenario and immediately formed the belief, this is good, or this is the right thing to do. So what we're trying to do today is explore different options of how that could be possible, how we could have that kind of moral knowledge. And we're going to consider some atheist options from people who call themselves Cornell realists, and we'll explain a little bit more about what that is, and also some atheistic moral Platonists like Eric Lindenberg. And finally, we're going to give a Christian response to how we could have moral knowledge. And I hope you enjoy the discussion, and with that, we'll get right over to the Dr. Baggett's office here where we had the interview, and see what he has to say. So then back to this challenge here. So how then, as you as a theist, are going to answer the challenge of the tracking problem here?
Yeah. Well, I can give you my thoughts on that. But maybe it would be best if we start with how some secularists try to answer the challenge.
Sure. Yeah.
Because then we can sort of compare our view with theirs. Okay. So there are two main sorts of general categories of naturalistic ethicists, right? There are those who say that moral truths, moral properties are in some sense reducible to just natural, physical, empirical properties, mm-hmm. right? So we'll call these the naturalistic ethicists. And then there are the others who aren't naturalists, probably, but more like Platonists, but they're atheists, right? Right. So they don't believe in God. Or if they do, they think God's irrelevant, right? There might be like the, you know, theoretical space for God or something like that, but God doesn't play any kind of role in the story, really. But what counts for them are, say, you know, abstract moral truths, maybe understood in a Platonic sort of sense. So we'll call these guys the Platonists, right? Okay. And I'm thinking of like David Enoch and Eric Weilenberg, for mm-hmm. example. And salient examples of the first category, the naturalistic ethicists, would be, say, the Cornell realists, or Philippa Foot would be another example. David Brink and Nicholas Sturgeon and, you know, these kinds of guys.
Mm-hmm.
All right. And Boyd, you know, and there's another one. So the naturalistic ethicists would say that, well, the reason why our moral beliefs track moral truth is because our moral beliefs are based upon various naturalistic properties, which are the very same thing as the moral properties.
Okay.
Right? So that's their account of how it is that our minds can track moral truth. So, you know, usually these guys don't say there's a simple correlation between moral properties and natural properties. They're more typically inclined to say something like, well, moral properties are likely the same as some kind of complex composite or collection of natural properties. And it might be very difficult to say exactly what those properties are, right? But some complicated set of naturalistic properties are the very same thing as the relevant moral properties, like moral goodness, moral rightness, moral obligatoriness, and so forth, right? And since via our senses and the like, we are able to apprehend empirical properties, natural properties and such, and these in some complex combination constitute the moral properties, right? Then we can directly apprehend moral properties. So that's their sort of story.
Yeah, let me ask you, but let's go back to the child example that you saw.
Right.
In that case, would they say something, I mean, well, maybe some of them might say something like, well, look, the rightness of the person giving the child food, that attains as a moral property because of the relation of the child and being hungry, standing into the person who has the food. And so it's kind of like this entire state of affairs that grounds this moral property. Is that right?
That's exactly
okay.
It. Yeah, and by grounding, we really mean like there's an identity relation between the relevant moral properties and some collection of natural properties. Okay. So it's not like the natural properties result in some new property called a moral property, which is a non-natural property.
Right.
That's going to be the Platonist view. And these guys instead say it's some complex collection of natural properties that are identical with the moral properties.
Okay.
So this is a straightforward account in the sense that, you know, you don't have to posit some kind of mysterious, you know, abstract object or anything like that. But the difficulty, it seems to me, despite the strengths of this view,
yeah,
in terms of its parsimony, in terms of its straightforward, you know, connection, in terms of its potential tracking account, is that moral properties just don't seem to be the sort of thing that are reducible to the physical properties. They just don't seem to be that way. Take a case where, you know, you're able to help the child and you have an obligation to help the child. Right? So now we're talking about a moral property that carries with it, we're inclined to think, a kind of authority, a kind of prescriptive force, and mm-hmm. so forth. Right? It's not at least clear to me why natural properties, bare natural properties, even in some complex collection, would generate features like that, you know, this sort of authoritative prescriptive power, such that if we don't behave in a particular way, we are actually, you know, guilty and this kind of thing, right? Why would natural properties result in things like that? I'm not saying it's impossible, but if we're looking for the best explanation, that kind of approach just strikes me as fundamentally inadequate.
Well, yeah, something I always think about this is it seems like on a naturalistic worldview, having any kind of property that would... So let's say we reduce the kind of obligation to some sort of like, well, it's not just... we're not talking about this sort of rich moral obligation, but sort of a rational obligation that may not be able to get the kind of obligation you're talking about, but we can say, well, look, given the situation and all the facts about it, it's the rational thing to do is for the man to give the child the bread, right? And this is due to the natural properties of the situation. But it seems to me that itself would be odd, because now you have intentional states that are related to these matter just arranged in a certain way. How can you get this sort of intentional, I'm supposed to have a certain kind of intention and bring about a certain kind of volition toward, how can that state obtain in a world that is completely composed of matter? Is that mm-hmm. my...
Yeah, I still think, yeah, right. Even in a story like that, yeah. they're going to have some stiff challenges to overcome to account for prescriptivity, even in the weaker sense,
yeah.
Right? And so I would quibble with that, along with, you know, the adequacy of that account of oughtness, because it does seem to me that at least on occasion, you know, there are really stronger senses of moral obligatoriness than that. And this is why a number of naturalists, at least one reason why a number of naturalists themselves, have begun gravitating in the direction of moral skepticism, because they recognize that the stronger sense of prescriptivity is the classical understanding of moral obligation, and they have a difficult time, by their own admission, accounting for it with the resources at their disposal, and they've grown increasingly skeptical of such things, and you know, they think them better left behind, and you know, they, instead of kind of watering down what morality is, they say, well, look, I mean, that is what morality has traditionally meant. We can't account for it, or can't account for it very well. And instead of giving up their naturalism, they decide to start giving up, you know, these moral, traditional moral convictions.
Well, so, let me ask you, before we go on,
yeah.
So how would you give an account on this sort of accordingly realist view here of intrinsic value? How does that, because if you think of intrinsic value, that seems to be something that obtains apart from any relation to anything else. But if we're going to say that moral properties exist when they are stand in the right relations, mm-hmm. then how can something be intrinsically valuable?
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Well, there are some Cornell realists, of course, who do wish to speak in terms of intrinsic value. They can one way to do it, and this is to use an insight from G.E. Moore, who was more of a Platonist, but. You could ask a question like this. So take the idea of say friendship and ask yourself this question: if friendship were removed from the world, do you think that you would have lost something of value, of intrinsic value? Would the world somehow be worse without friendship than with it? And if you think intuitively that mm-hmm. the answer to that question is, yeah, the world would be worse, then this gives you some reason to think that such a thing as friendship has, you know, intrinsic value, right? So this is sort of called the annihilation test, you know. And there are various other tests, you know, the isolation test, annihilation test, and others that can gauge people's intuitions. And so usually this is kind of what's done, it seems to me, among various naturalistic ethicists, is they attempt to affirm the value of certain things for being intrinsic worth, right? Not merely of instrumental worth, but it's kind of valuable in and of themselves. Of course, consequentialists generally are going to focus more on the instrumental values, save for whatever the centerpiece is of their particular theory of the good. So if it's something like, you know, happiness or something like that, they might say, well, at least that has intrinsic value. But then everything else has instrumental value insofar as it is productive of happiness, or the maximization of happiness, minimization of unhappiness, or something like that. In general, what I find to be a little suspicious and potentially inadequate about what naturalists say about intrinsic value is that, yeah, it seems to me they're just sort of appealing to these intuitions that we have that some things are intrinsically valuable. And I think they're right. I agree with their intuitions. I have the same intuitions. But I don't think that recognizing our intuitions about things having intrinsic value is an account of intrinsic value. I think it's more of a descriptive thing, you know, like, well, descriptively speaking, we have these intuitions that some things are of intrinsic value. I agree.
Right.
That's not the same as saying, and here is why they have intrinsic value. Yeah. you know, and merely saying that, you know, we'd rather the world have these things than without. I don't think that goes deeply enough in accounting for, you know, a deep sense of intrinsic value. And again, I'm not saying it's utterly impossible for naturalists to use this language, certainly not saying that, or even to maybe come up with some account to some degree of their existence. But the way I run the moral argument is abductively. And I always ask, want to ask, you know, well, what's going to be the better explanation for intrinsic values? A naturalistic perspective or, say, a theistic one in which persons are the foundation of reality and a person and we have been made in God's image and God loves us and this is a personalist universe and all of this. And when you have that kind of picture, right, can you come up with a deeper, richer, more robust account of intrinsic value? And it seems to me that you can. So that would be one of my problems there. It seems to me that the naturalists often kind of, in a sense, water down the notions of both intrinsic value and moral obligations, and in order to make the concepts in question kind of fit more comfortably into their worldview.
Well, I think just before we go on here, I think another point that's relevant here is, this is just another example of how we're not, what you're not saying is that the naturalist can't have moral knowledge or they can't apprehend moral effects. They can apprehend things that are, what is intrinsically valuable, for example, or what is right to do. The question is just whether or not their worldview can explain how it is that these things are the way that they are and how we have knowledge of them, right?
Yeah, I totally agree with that. I think that naturalists can apprehend that, say, friendships have intrinsic value.
Right.
I am not at all inclined to deny that. In part because even if I were to argue, and I'm not arguing this right now, but even if I were to argue, say, naturalism cannot sustain the category of intrinsic value, even if I were to argue that, it wouldn't follow that I would say naturalists can't apprehend the intrinsic value of friendship,
right?
Because it wouldn't follow unless naturalism were true.
Yeah.
So and as I don't happen to think that naturalism is true, I think plenty of naturalists are tapping into all sorts of truths that are best explained by theism without their realizing it. You know. So you know, I mean, I think that naturalists and atheists have been created by God and in his image and have great intrinsic worth, infinite value and dignity and so forth. They might not believe that, right? But of course the truth is independent of their belief potentially, right? I mean, their belief could simply be false. So if we're right and this is a theistic world, the naturalists themselves, right, don't live in a naturalistic world.
Right, yeah.
So, yeah, there's that. But, yeah, I definitely think that naturalists, as human beings, with the cognitive capacities that they have and the noetic faculties they have and such, are able to apprehend all manner of moral truths and that those apprehensions are, in fact, veridical. So I'm not inclined to say that, you know, naturalists don't have moral knowledge or something like that.
Right.
And if naturalism is true and naturalism is a defeater for moral knowledge, then nobody would have moral knowledge, either believers or unbelievers, right? So we're not in a different boat in terms of moral knowledge here. If there are differences, it's going to have to be cashed out in a different way.
Okay, so let's go. So let's pick up back again with the foot version of the people who are talking about, under the Cornell realists, are talking about moral knowledge as this identical to a certain collection of physical properties. And we were telling that their story then is that since the moral properties are identical to certain groupings of natural properties, that where do we go from there in terms of how we actually get knowledge of these moral properties?
Well, on their view, it would be largely an empirical sort of event. It seems to me where we apprehend the empirical properties, the natural properties, and since those are moral properties, there is at least the possibility of a direct tracking relation there. But, and again, my biggest problem with that is that moral properties seem to be just a different sort of thing than the natural properties.
But so let me ask this. So even if we grant this, that moral properties are identical to collections of natural properties, it doesn't seem like that these new properties, or maybe that's not the right word, but these moral properties have any sort of, it's not as if those, though the situation, once the physical things are grouped together the right way, has any sort of new causal power or something. I mean, what about it is relatively different than some group of physical things over here to, you know, let's say you have a pile of rocks over here that are, don't have any moral properties, and then you have the child and the man giving him food over here. It doesn't seem like any kind of causal relation can be explicated on physicalist terms between these two things that would make me generate one belief in one case and another in the other case. Is that, you see what I'm saying there?
Yeah, I mean, I think part of the intuition behind this is that moral properties seem to require more than just the physical properties.
Right.
And I agree with that. That's, in fact, my biggest kind of beef with the whole approach. And then there's this other intuition that you have that, well, I mean, if it were to work in the situation with the child, then why wouldn't it work with the rocks? Right, because it's not in dispute. It wouldn't work with the rock, so right. Why would it work in the other case, right? And they want to say that it does. I suspect that there they want to say things like, you know, distinctive features of human beings, our capacity for sentience, our capacity for suffering, our capacity for helping those in need, yeah. Our ability to communicate, our ability to think, our ability to have various effective responses to situations, our capacity for rationality, all of these various things and more combine in such a way that, you know, the moral properties will supervene in the one case, but not in the other. That's, I think, going to be their general story.
Yeah. I guess, so my question with that, the answer is just, it just does, but how does... So I'm granting them that the moral property is identical, that it exists in this situation. We're talking about the humans, the child and the man, right? But I'm wondering, how can it then play a causal role in my forming a belief about that situation?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, if we naturally find ourselves believing, you know, in the moral propriety of helping the starving child, they want to suggest that the moral belief in question came about as a direct result of our finding ourselves in a particular situation, being appeared to in a particular sort of way. And all of that story is explicable on naturalistic terms, okay, on their view, right? So we have the belief, we form the belief, however that happens,
right?
But we know it does, so, you know, there's no disputing that, right? So we form beliefs in various situations, right? But if those beliefs happen to correspond with these moral truths out there that are that, and these empirical properties are constitutive of those truths, then there's at least some, you know, semblance of causal connection, right, between the relevant empirical properties and the relevant moral beliefs. Right. So our cognitive capacities enable us to form beliefs.
Right.
Right. And so, you know, we find ourselves in certain situations forming certain various beliefs. Right. So in a subset of situations in which, you know, there's something morally significant going on, at least on their view, there's this kind of connection, right, between the relevant empirical properties constitutive of those moral truths and the moral beliefs that we form somehow or other, right? I mean, maybe we're hardwired such that when we see a suffering child, we find the experience to be aversive, right? We just don't like to see that sort of thing. And so we feel like there's something bad about it. And on the assumption that there really is something bad about it, explicable on naturalistic terms, the idea is the experience led to our belief, and the belief corresponded with the moral truth in question.
Okay.
The moral truth in question came about as a result of that complex collection of naturalistic or empirical properties, right, that we were able to apprehend.
Okay.
That's the general story that they're telling. And again, my biggest problem with it, where I'm less skeptical about it, is that it seems to me that when we talk about distinctively moral properties, the idea that they are simply reducible to empirical properties, right, seems misguided. All right. Moral properties pertain to things like, you know, the way things ought to be and the way they ought to be, right? And you know, empirical properties are what they are. So how do you go from the is to the ought? How do you go from the description to the prescription? From the non-moral to the moral all of a sudden, right? To me, that's all altogether mysterious. I can understand the impulse behind what they're trying to do, right? Because as naturalists, and they want to retain their moral realism, they want to be able to cash this out in terms of empirical properties. I get it.
Right.
But there just seems to be a qualitative chasm between those two kinds of properties that leaves me skeptical.
Okay. Well, you want to move on to Uhlenberg and the Platonists now?
Sure.
And talk about them a little bit?
Sure. Now, the Platonists will say it's not that the moral properties are reducible to the empirical properties, but instead they, in some sense, supervene on the natural properties in a way other than identity.
What does supervenience mean?
Think of supervenience as a dependence relation of some sort.
Oh, right.
And you can cash out different ways in which there's a dependence relation. You might say that the Cornell realists believe in supervenience too, but it's a dependence relation involving simple identity, right? What the Platonists, though, are going to say is that, no, the moral properties are something above and beyond the physical properties, but they still depend on those physical properties, okay. Generally.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, this is how they're going to say it. And some Platonists wouldn't say it that way, but Uhlenberg certainly does, for example. So in these cases of the Platonists, there are these moral properties that aren't just reducible to physical properties. Now, how is it then that they're going to account for moral knowledge, right? That was the question, right?
Right.
So how are these guys going to account for moral knowledge? So, well, the way Uhlenberg does it is he says, okay, I admit that we can't come up with a causal tracking relation. He admits this.
Right.
But he doesn't thereby infer that moral knowledge is impossible. He says, what I can do is I can come up with a different sort of account for why there's a correspondence between moral beliefs and moral truths.
Okay, right.
Now, first, what does he mean by moral truth? The moral truths, again, are going to be those abstract moral properties and relations and so forth that supervene in a non-identity sense on empirical properties.
Right.
Okay. So you set the cat on fire. This causes, say, moral wrongness, right? So simultaneous with the event, moral wrongness is instantiated. But it's not the very same thing as the physical properties. It's this other kind of property. There really is such a thing as a moral property, but it's causally inert.
Right.
And because it's causally inert, on his view, it can't directly cause your moral belief. So this is why he despairs of a causal tracking relation.
Okay.
But he says, I can give you what he calls a third factor account or analysis of why it is there's a correspondence between our moral beliefs and the moral truths in question. And he thinks the third factor is our moral cognitive faculties. Okay? Because it's those faculties that account, as we were just discussing, for our moral beliefs, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we see the cat set on fire for fun by a group of teenagers, and we immediately form the belief, oh, that's wrong. Okay, so that's not in dispute. That seems clearly straightforward. However that works, we form that belief, right? But it's also the case that those cats, he thinks, really shouldn't have been set on fire for fun, right? Because it's going to cause all this gratuitous suffering and so forth. And those you know, properties make it true.
Let me ask you a question before.
Yeah.
Is it wrong because it's going to cause gratuitous suffering, or is it wrong because it creates this relation to this abstract moral truth out here? Or is it, I mean, maybe it's both.
I think it's both. I mean, he's not a consequentialist. And I didn't mean to imply that. Yeah. But, you know, the idea is like this gratuitous imposition of suffering on all, you know, on these harmless, you know, innocent animals and so forth, right? Yeah. Intuitively, that's something that's wrong, right? Okay. And he would agree with that. You know, his intuitions are very, you know, very sort of standard in that way.
Right.
And I don't think he would give necessarily a purely consequentialist analysis, but then again, you know, consequences can be part of an overall moral assessment of a situation, even if one is not a thoroughgoing consequentialist, right? Okay, so yeah, so whatever causes the wrongness there, right? It comes into being. It is instanced or instantiated the moment at which this event takes place, right? So the empirical properties obtain. The moral property obtains its cause to be instantaneously. But it's not a physical property. Okay. Now, our cognitive faculties, though, are able to apprehend what's going on at the physical level here.
Right. Okay.
And can give us reasons why the event was wrong.
Reasons why we should think it was wrong.
Reasons to think that it was wrong.
Right.
And in some cases, like in this case, compelling, decisive reasons to believe that it should not have been done. That in point of fact, it would be a violation of the right of the animal, maybe, or less controversially, perhaps, we would have an obligation not to perform such an action.
Right.
Okay? Now, on his view, obligations come about as a result of, you know, our recognition, our apprehension of enough reasons to engage in a particular action or to refrain from engaging in a particular action. When enough of those decisive moral reasons add up, a moral obligation results. See? So, on this view, it's true that we have an obligation not to mistreat the animal in this way.
Right.
We have the cognitive ability to recognize the obligation that we have not to treat the animal in this way.
Right? That's not recognition of this Platonic moral truth, but recognition of things like consequences and the value of the cat and that kind of a thing.
I think he wants to say we can recognize the truth of the moral proposition in question.
We're actually going to recognize somehow the abstract object.
Well, we're going to recognize that we have an obligation not to treat the child in that way.
Okay.
Now, in his view, I think it might be something like properly basic.
Okay.
In that, when we are appeared to in a particular way, we don't necessarily infer to it. We just will find ourselves believing that we have this obligation.
Right.
Okay. I think that's the way he'd put it, because I don't think he wants to speak in like those mysterious sounding terms, like we recognize the abstract truth. He wants to say, look, there is this abstract truth, right? Uh-huh. But what we do is, in applying our cognitive faculties, is we either discursively infer to the existence of the obligation based upon the empirical properties that we see,
uh-huh.
which are collectively constitutive of those moral properties, right? Or we have the noetic faculties directly to non-discursively infer the existence of the obligation. In either case, we're able to apprehend the truth that there's an obligation not to mistreat the animal.
Right.
Okay. So our cognitive faculties can explain both our belief, right, and also the truth in question, because the truth in question is coming about as a result of enough of those reasons that are accessible to us adding together to constitute an obligation. So he thinks that this third factor understanding can connect up our moral belief with the moral truth. Our moral belief with the moral truth. So it's not that the moral truth directly causes our moral belief, right? But our cognitive faculties enable us to apprehend the obligation because we recognize that there are enough compelling, decisive reasons not to behave in that way, and also can explain our belief, right? And there's a correspondence, not a direct causal relation, but a correspondence between the moral truth and the moral belief.
So let me see if I understand this correctly here. Is it so when you say so it's in our cognitive faculties give or perceive the reasons that are there, and that creates the obligation. Is that right?
Yeah, when we on his view, and he follows Derek Parfit in this way, when we have enough of a particular set of reasons, to engage in a particular action, an obligation results.
Okay, so the question I would have been, does it matter whether I'm aware of the reasons I have for action or not, or does it just matter that I would, objectively speaking, have reasons
for action? Right. Yeah, I think that's a really good question for a few different reasons. Because on the one hand, it seems like you would want to say, yeah, if you're culpably not thinking as you should, then you might well have an obligation that you just fail to recognize, but for culpable reasons, and right. So you're still culpable for not performing the action or for performing an action you shouldn't have, because you're responsible for the decisions that you made that precluded you from seeing things clearly. All right, I mean that seems intuitive for him to say something like that. I'm not sure he would. I suspect he might though. But it seems to me it's also an interesting question because. And I've had this thought about Wielenberg before. It seems to me he's almost operating at different times with two different conceptions of moral obligations. On the one hand, this kind of domesticated account of moral obligations that is explicable and closer to naturalistic terms, right. Where you just have enough reasons that added up to result in this obligation.
Right.
On the other hand, this kind of top-down idea of an authoritative obligation that's really there that dictates to you what it is you ought to do, right? And as a Platonist, I mean, you'd think that he would gravitate more in that direction. And there are times when it seems like he wants to say something like that. But that's in tension, it seems to me, with this more bottom-up, more naturalistic-sounding, piling up of reasons that culminates in an obligation.
Right.
Because, you see, the two pictures, I think, go in different directions, right? Is it that you have enough reasons that when they add up, you're like, oh, now I have an obligation?
Right.
Or is it instead you immediately apprehend the obligation and you recognize that the obligation itself gives you reasons and potentially quite authoritative and decisive and overriding reasons to act.
Right.
And you it seems to reverse the whole direction of the causal order. I'm more inclined, and this is my biggest kind of problem with his whole approach, to think of obligations as more top-down than he does. I think of obligations as giving us the reasons, not as the reasons culminating in obligations, right.
Of course, or they could be both, and he's just missing half of the equation. It could be that you could have a sort of rational obligation to not, to treat cats a certain way that exists by virtue of the natural properties that are there. But then you would still be missing the sort of, oomph of an obligation that we also think we have to not torture animals for fun.
Yeah, that's interesting. So, so you're connecting up his account of obligations, what I've been calling this bottom up, as sort of the rational ought, and then my moral obligation in that other sense as the more moral ought. That's an interesting suggestion. That might be right. By the way, it's funny you use the word oomph because this very word is used by Richard Joyce, in his book to characterize this authoritative notion of moral obligations as possessing unavoidable prescriptive power. He calls it clout or oomph.
Yeah.
Right.
Capital O obligations versus little O obligations.
And I really think that, we've had this discussion before, I really think that this is a part, it's not the whole of morality, but I think it's an important part of morality for us to really make sense of that. Think about Hitler, right? And his treatment of the Jews, right? I mean, I think it makes perfect sense for us to say, and we shouldn't hesitate to say it, right? He should not have treated them in that way.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
I mean, it just seems so obvious. And this is a case of Kantian perfect duties, where you know you're violating the rights of these people, the human basic human rights of these people, to treat them in that sort of horrific, dehumanizing, despicable sort of way. This behavior should not be done. We don't have to just add up the reasons and then make this inference about the obligations. Right, right. It's like, no, look, humans have moral standing. Humans have more worth and dignity, such that to treat them in that way is categorically wrong. No excuses at all whatsoever. If a worldview can't just simply embrace that, mm-hmm. endorse that, and explain that, then it seems to me so much the worse for that worldview. And so this robust category of categorical moral oughtness, I think is just a category that we should be very slow to let go of. And I think that often what happens with our naturalist friends is that they subtly have to water that category down, to domesticate it, to make it a little weaker in order to make it explicable on the terms of their worldview. But again, what are you more sure of? You know, the naturalism or the atheism on the one hand, or the wrongness of child torture for fun, the wrongness of mistreating the Jews during the Holocaust that was done. I mean, it just seems to me that those moral truths are the more non-negotiable.
Yeah.
And why not use moral truths to shape your worldview, you know, as opposed to deciding on your worldview ahead of time, you know, bracketing the moral questions till later and then trying to fit them into the myopic confines of a worldview that might well not be able to do justice to them. I say, bring those non-negotiable moral intuitions into the very process of constructing your worldview. And that, of course, is the whole rationale behind moral apologetics, right? The moral argument for God's existence. If theism can better explain these various moral realities and our knowledge of them, then it seems to me this is a reason to take theism seriously and take the Christianity more seriously. So Wielenberg is one example of a Platonist, and then David Enoch is another, and he gives a third factor approach to moral knowledge as well. So in his book Taking Morality Seriously, what David Enoch does is he says, well, look. It's a good thing for human beings to survive. Evolution has conduced to human survival.
Right.
So this debunking challenge from evolutionary ethics can be answered in this sort of way. There is a way in which our moral beliefs track moral truth in this sense. Our moral beliefs came about as a result of an evolutionary process, right? And we formed the beliefs that we did as being morally significant as they are, because, as it happens, they conduce to our survival, our reproductive advantage, and all of that. But because our survival is a good thing, mm-hmm. right, then our beliefs track moral truth, right?
Right.
Because it's morally true that our existence is a good thing, our survival, our flourishing, our thriving, and so forth, right? And we have formed the beliefs that we did because they conduce to our reproductive advantage and our survival. So there is this third factor approach. Again, it's not a direct causal relationship, tracking relationship. It's a correspondence between our moral beliefs and the moral truths. In the context of evolution, evolution conduces to our survival. Evolution gives us the moral beliefs that we have, which conduce to our survival. So there you have it. This third factor, then, that it's a good thing that we survive, can explain both moral truth and our moral belief.
Right. Okay.
My answer to that is, I think it has some potential, but you know, we devote a whole chapter in Good God, and we discuss in God and Cosmos, and we discussed this, you and I, a couple months ago. We devoted a whole chapter to the issue of intrinsic human value and worth, and how theism can explain it better
mm-hmm.
than can our naturalist friends. And so it seems to me that Enoch's argument has some potential, but that it would be a stronger and better argument if you could not just point to the existence of human beings as being better than their non-existence,
right?
Which is all that he says he needs. He says he doesn't even need intrinsic human value or anything like that, right? But it seems to me if you do have something like intrinsic human value, that then you could take his argument and use it, and it would be an even stronger argument, because now you're talking about the ongoing existence of beings who have intrinsic moral value.
Right.
So there's not just some sense or other that their existence is better than not their non-existence. No, their existence is actually a good and valuable thing because they possess inherent dignity and worth, value, significance, all these sorts of things, right? Now their survival is all the more morally significant. And if indeed evolution forms our moral beliefs and conduces to our survival and thriving and flourishing as intrinsically valuable creatures, there's an even tighter connection between our the moral truths in question and the moral beliefs. So you could use this sort of third factor approach on theism, I think, even more effectively than you can on his naturalistic assumptions. So you asked how we approach it as theists, right? It seems to me, at this point anyway, I might just say, look, there's a variety of ways to go here.
Mm-hmm.
Right? You could take something like Enoch's approach and bolster it with the deeper assumptions and arguments that we have as theists for intrinsic human value and argue for a third factor approach, right, that accounts for the correspondence between moral truth and moral belief in that way. Or potentially you could give a more direct causal relation tracking approach by pointing, as Angus Ritchie does, you know, to God having structured the whole, say, evolutionary process in such a way that we come to know moral truths in a more direct fashion. God has, you know, structured our minds and noetic faculties in such a way that we actually can apprehend moral truths, perhaps not unlike the way we can apprehend, you know, mathematical truths or epistemic right. truths or aesthetic truths. You're not going to be able to give, it seems to me, so compelling an account of a direct tracking relation on a naturalistic story. But if God structured us intentionally in that kind of way and gave us those sorts of capacities and so forth, that kind of teleological picture, at least so argues Ritchie, is a potentially, you know, effective way in which to argue that a tracking relation is possible after all. So you have different sorts of possibilities, it seems to me, as theists. But the way Ritchie puts it is this. He says, look, even if it's the case that naturalists have moral knowledge, right, what they lack is a really good explanation of how it is that we can have moral knowledge, right? And I'm inclined to agree with that. See, so unlike those who push the point that, look, on naturalism, moral knowledge is absolutely impossible, I'm more inclined to say, well, naturalists may well have moral knowledge. Again, to begin with, you know, it might not be a naturalistic world.
Right.
But even if it were a naturalistic world and moral knowledge were possible, okay, the question becomes, in light of the moral knowledge in this world, what's the better explanation, right, for the facts of moral knowledge? For the facts of moral knowledge. And this is on the assumption that there are moral truths, right?
Right.
And I think that, you know, we have the better explanation as theists of that. But set that aside, right? Even on the assumption that there is moral truth, what's the better explanation of moral knowledge? And it seems to me, either way you go, with a third factor approach or with a direct tracking approach, the theistic story is going to be the better story, the more likely true story for how moral knowledge is possible. And so this is just, to my thinking, one more piece of evidence from morality in favor of a theistic view of the world.
Okay, well, I hope you enjoyed the conversation there with Dr. Baggett. I don't always learn from these interviews that I get to conduct as the host here. So I hope you do too. Next week, we have a really exciting podcast with Dr. Chad Thornhill on the impeccability and humanity of Jesus and why it matters for morality. Really looking forward to that. Make sure you stay tuned. And keep an eye on the website. You know, we got stuff going up the 3 times a week, at least usually, from biblical scholars, philosophers, literary scholars, poets. And don't miss our special series on Friday. You know, you have to check in on Mr. Ichabod and his uncle Apollyon there. And, yeah, well, hope you enjoyed the show, and hope to have you back again next week. And thanks for listening to the podcast of moralapologetics.com.